Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, man, there is so much in the news. There is so much going on. The Republican battle against the middle class, the conservative effort to destroy America, continues full tilt, Boogie. It is running so fast. We will be getting into many dimensions of that as we go through our program. In our second hour, Allison Kasich is going to drop by. She's with the Independent Women's Forum, the conservative group that Michelle Bernard heads up. And we're going to be talking about a variety of things, but basically the large frame will be the gun law in Washington, D.C. that was struck down by the Supreme Court. And her suggestion that this means, isn't this a wonderful thing? Women can all carry guns and protect themselves. Interesting. Well, and in our third hour, Barry Siegel, who won a Pulitzer Prize for feature writing, former L.A. Times national correspondent, his new book, Claim of Privilege, about state secrecy. And from that, I want to step in our third hour into a rather protracted conversation about Barack Obama and the whole FISA bill thing and this ongoing disaster. It looks like it's going to be voted on tomorrow. So we will see how that plays out. But I want to start out with just this whole issue of this Republican war, this economic war, because it all ultimately boils down to economics. This is the bottom line. This is where it all goes. Let me just share with you some news stories as starting points, I think, and see where we go with this. This is from today's Financial Times. Abu Dhabi considers an end of the dollar peg. Right now, Abu Dhabi is tying their currency to the U.S. dollar. And the problem is that because of 30 years of Republican policies, conservative economic policies, because we have replaced old-fashioned demand-side economics that was the way that this country was run for 300 years, 230 years formally, but you know, arguably goes back thousands of years. Because we have replaced demand-side economics, an economics that says there are people out there who want to buy things, gee, I think I'll start a business to sell it to them, with supply-side economics, this invention that came along during the Reagan administration that says, let's take the public money and give it to wealthy people in the hopes that they will build factories and they will get more wealthy. And in the process of buying more yachts, there'll be more jobs building yachts. And in the process of their buying new Gulfstream aircraft, there'll be more jobs for Gulfstream. And hopefully they'll build a factory and make something that will cause us to want to buy it. This has been a disaster. It doesn't work. So we have that, piece number one. Piece number two, because traditional demand-side economics said, oh, and by the way, I should say, welcome to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Because traditional, and welcome back from the 4th of July holiday, boy, I've been writing all week on this book I'm working on, and it was a nice and useful break and a tip of the hat, and many thanks to Mark Maron for filling in the 2 days he did, and I hope you had a fine 4th of July. Anyhow. The traditional traditional concept of economics is that people buy things because they have the money in their pocket to buy them. In other words, what drives an economy is demand, and the demand comes in part out of the fact that people have the means to supply that, to fulfill that demand. In other words, they're making enough money they can buy things. Well, there were really two pieces to Reaganomics. The first part of Reaganomics was, we're going to forget about whether or not people can afford to buy things. We're simply going to take, we're going to tax, Ronald Reagan doubled the tax on working people, literally doubled the tax on working people, and put into place huge tax breaks, dropping from 70% down to 28%. The taxes on people who were making over $3.2 million in today's dollars a year, dramatically dropped the taxes on the very wealthy. And on corporations. Corporations before Reagan came into office were paying about 35% of the total cost of infrastructure in the United States, the total cost of police and fire and everything else that corporations use. And Reagan began the systematic destruction of that. We're down now to around 7-8% of our taxes in the United States are paid by corporations. The rest are paid by individual taxpayers, you and me. No wonder people are going, oh, my God, my taxes are so high. Yeah, well, there's a reason. So, in any case, the Reagan administration came to the conclusion, as a result of this supply-side insanity that was promulgated largely by people like Phil Graham. Phil Graham, who is John McCain's chief economic advisor, that Phil Graham, and Alan Greenspan, who was has been economic advisor to a variety of presidents from Reagan through Clinton. Anyhow, they said, it doesn't matter if people have the money to buy stuff or not, because we're all about jacking up corporate profits. We've got to increase profits for corporations. So by increasing profits for corporations, number one, we're going to cut their taxes, corporations and the wealthy. Number one, we're going to cut their taxes. Number two, we're going to give them more government money, subsidies, bonuses, benefits, protections, you know, Price Anderson for the nuclear industry, more free federal land for the oil industry, the mining industry, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to change the way that our rules of international trade so that their manufacturing floors can move overseas. They can make their cars in Mexico. They can make their toys in China. And so basically labor becomes cheaper as a consequence of that. Then the corporate profits go up as well. We didn't see necessarily in many cases. I mean, there are a lot of products from jeans to tennis shoes to fill in the blank where prices never really went down. What happened was profits went up. So the bottom line was destroy the ability of the wage earner to earn money and shift all this money up to the top. Now, there's a slight problem here. Who's going to buy anything if they don't have income anymore? We've seen the wages of the real earning power of the average American worker steadily erode. I mean, it climbed for years and years and years, and it has been steadily eroding, you know, pretty much from the get-go. From 1949 to 1959, U.S. median family income grew by 37%. From 1959 until 1970, it grew by 41%. We're talking substantial increases in the income of working people. I mean, people were making more money every year. Everybody knew that they could do better than their dad. I mean, it was just, you know, and every year was a better year. But when Reagan came along, the growth of actually during the last couple of years of the Carter administration, and this was in part because we were wringing out all the borrowed money from the Vietnam War, that dropped down to 6.8% throughout the 70s. And 97% of that went to the top 20% of families. Since Reagan, real income for wage-earning Americans, people who earn a paycheck rather than make their money on dividends and income, real income has gone down steadily, continues to. So the Republicans looked at this and they said, okay, you know, this is working out great for our fat cat campaign contributors. This is working out great for the top, you know, 1%, 2% of Americans. It's working out well for the millionaires and the billionaires, the top one-tenth of 1%. But we got this problem. We got consumers all across America who are not buying stuff, who can't afford to buy stuff. What are we going to do? And Greenspan came along and said, loosen credit. Let them borrow. You know, during the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, when we were seeing 30, 40, 50% increases in wage growth over every decade, during that period of time, as America's middle class grew strong, people bought their homes, they bought their cars, they bought land, they bought physical things, they owned things, they had pensions, they had assets. Let's strip them of those assets. Let's make it easy for them to refinance their house as times get tougher. Let's make it easy for them to buy a car on credit, or not even buy a car, simply lease a car. Let's make it easy for them to get credit card debt, to jack up credit card debt and run it really high. And let's make it really easy for the credit card companies to really screw them. So basically what has happened is over the last 30 years, Americans have been thrown massively into debt as a way, and by government policy, encouraging Americans to throw themselves massively in debt as a way to keep buying stuff, to keep the economy going. And here we are now, it's coming to an end. It's coming to an end in two ways. Number one, we're reaching the limits of credit. Americans are tapped out. Americans are so broke they can't afford to borrow money anymore. And number two, the government has been doing the same thing. 70% of the total debt of America was run up by three Republican presidents, two Bushes and a Reagan. And the consequence of this is that our dollar is falling through the floor. And so we come back to this original news story. I started this with Abu Dhabi ponders end of dollar peg. Countries like in the Middle East are saying, don't think we want to do dollars anymore, which will be a real disaster.
Tom Hartman.
Exposing the con in conservatives.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. 21 minutes past the hour. Here's just some aspects of this. Okay, I set up how this happened. We moved from people earning money and spending that money, a demand-based economy, to people being taxed, the money being given to rich folks, the rich folks in most cases saving it or moving it over to China. But in any case, so people, in order to maintain the lifestyle that they had in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, had to start borrowing, and now we're all tapped out. So where do we go now? Not only are we tapped out, but as Dick Cheney says, you know, Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Yeah. So here in the Sunday paper and Sunday Parade magazine intelligence report, for sale, U.S. roads. Some of America's cash-strapped states and cities are leasing public roads. The highest bidders, often foreign investors. Chicago's famous Skyway is controlled by the Spanish-Australian investment group. An Italian firm operates the Dulles Greenway outside Washington, D.C. So, gee, you want to get to the nation's airport, the nation's capital's airport, Dulles? You have to go on a greenway that's owned by a company out of Italy. Yes, Mr. Berlusconi, Salvador Berlusconi is going to be the guy who, you know, I mean, this is how bizarre it gets, right? Abu Dhabi says they're going to drop their connection to the dollar. Why? Because the dollar is inflating like crazy. They're experiencing 11% inflation in Abu Dhabi because they don't jigger their inflation numbers. Kevin Phillips says our inflation numbers are total nonsense. He says, in real numbers, he says, you look at what happened. He says, there's a whole series of things. Clinton administration changed them. In 94, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said, oh, by the way, if you work for less than a year, you're discouraged. We're no longer going to count you. 4 million people, bang, just like that, fell off the unemployment rolls, fell off the official statistics of unemployed people because they were so-called discouraged workers. Sure did look good for the Clinton economy. Wasn't so good for us. They also thinned the economic sample by a sixth. They cut it from 60,000. We used to sample 60,000 families. They cut it down to 50,000. And guess who the 10,000 they didn't sample anymore were? People in inner cities. So we're no longer looking at the areas where unemployment is highest in the United States. Bottom line, we got totally phony numbers. According to Kevin Phillips, who's, I mean, this, you know, one of the top writers, economists, and frankly, conservatives in America. He says the real numbers, here's the real numbers. Today's U.S. unemployment rate is actually between 9 and 12%. Our inflation rate is actually between 7 and 10%. Our economic growth, Other, you know, once you take out the rich and the super rich, not there. We're creeping into recession. That's Kevin Phillips. Meanwhile, because our dollar has fallen so far, who won this battle between George W. Bush and Osama bin Laden? To the extent that it was a battle, I'm not sure it ever was, because Bush never really went after bin Laden. Bin Laden's sitting there in Pakistan having a good old time, and we're mired in Iraq. But nonetheless, in 1998, Osama bin Laden gave an interview in which he said that, you know, one of the things that was really wrong with the world was the fact that we were stealing oil from Saudi Arabia, his holy land. We were paying 11 bucks a barrel for oil in 1998. How much did he say it should be? He said it should be at least $144 a barrel. Guess what the price hit last week? $144 a barrel. Osama bin Laden has won the economic war against the United States. He is bankrupting us. But it's not Osama bin Laden who's doing it. It's Bush and Bush policies. That's the bottom line. I mean, it comes right straight down to that. On top of that, we just got last Friday 62,000 jobs lost. This is 6 months in a row of jobs lost. Nobody's mentioning the fact that if there were no jobs lost, there would still be jobs lost, because there's 115,000 people coming into the job market every month as young people graduate from high school and college and come into the job market at higher numbers than the numbers of people who are retiring and dying. So you have to have 115,000 a month just to keep even. During the eight years of the Bush or of the Clinton administration, over 30 million jobs were created. During the 7.5 years of the Bush administration so far, 3 million jobs have been created. Now, granted, under Bushonomics and under the second half of Clintonomics, if you got fired from your good full-time union job and you took a part-time job working at Walmart and a part-time job working at 7-Eleven, you were now considered to be two employed people. In other words, they have two jobs. So according to statistics, things went up. So, I mean, that's how bad it is. And now it's cracking down into the 401ks. All along, the cons have been saying, oh, we just need to privatize Social Security. People need choice, right? Like they need choice in their medicine. They need choice in their 401ks, in their retirement. Forget Social Security. That idea of a pension, that's so outmoded. People want to have a fixed amount of money, not an amount of money that'll pay them every day for the rest of their lives, no matter how long they live, like Social Security is, which is a pension. Instead, we want to have a defined benefit plan or a fixed benefit plan. We want to have a program where you put in $100,000, you get out $100,000 plus interest. Well, the bottom line is, or the problem is, most 401ks are actually invested in the stock market. And what's happening in the stock market? Gee, it's going south. You hearing anybody promoting privatization of Social Security? I don't. I'm telling you, the Republicans are destroying our economy for everybody except them. The Phil Grahams, the George Bushes, the Dick Cheneys of the world, they're doing very well, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour, bringing democracy back to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. See, increasingly Americans are figuring out that the entire basis of conservative economics, of Reaganomics, of Republicanomics, and really, you know, Reaganomics was just putting a new name on something that went back all the way to the 1800s. You know, the age of the robber barons that brought us the Republican Great Depression of 1929, 1930, that brought us the Republican Depression of 1892, that, you know, on and on and on. Really, people are starting to figure out that what this is all about is rule by an economic elite. That's what the Republicans are all about, and not the average person. It's one of the reasons Doonesbury's cartoon this weekend was so spot on. It's one of the reasons they're working so hard to disenfranchise voters. In fact, there's a couple of articles. Mark Crispin Miller sent me one over the weekend suggesting that many states are going to have really serious problems this fall with regard to voting because they've been foreclosed on. We're looking at a couple of million people who have been foreclosed on. When they show up at the voting polls to vote, their voting registration card shows their old home address, which is no longer their home address. Their home address is now showing as vacant or somebody else, and there will be Republican challengers at the polls saying, sorry, you can't vote. Now, when somebody's been foreclosed on, and again, we're talking a couple million people here, when somebody's been foreclosed on, do you think that they're going to vote for four more years of George Bush's economic disastrous policy? I doubt it. So the Republican machine already working to disenfranchise even more voters than ever before. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Frank down in L.A., listening on K-Talk. Hey, Frank,
what's up? The Republican Party was after the New Deal from its inception, and they want to substitute it with the raw deal.
Well said, Frank.
They definitely want an underclass society so that they'll work for less than minimum wage because they consider minimum wage too much.
Yeah.
And they're on their way to making this a third world country with the devaluation of the dollar, and the price of oil signifies that. You know, mm-hmm. The Arabs are not dumb. They're not going to take a 50-cent dollar for a barrel of oil when they could get a dollar, so they're double, they're charging twice as much.
Yeah.
But the Reagan economics, after he left office, they determined that all the money that he gave the people that made $1 million or more a year, all they did was reinvest that money into gold, silver, stocks and bonds, and they never built new factories to create more jobs.
Well, actually, quite a few of them built new factories, but they built them in Mexico and in China.
That's right. That's another thing they've done. But the Bush policy is a continuation of the Reagan policy. But Reagan didn't finish it completely, and Bush is on his way to completing it. And unfortunately, I don't understand why anybody would vote for a Republican, because I wouldn't vote for Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. Abe Lincoln was a different. Wait a second. Abe Lincoln was a Republican when the Republican Party was the Reform Party, because at that time the Democratic Party had become basically a fairly corrupt, entrenched power system that was largely fueled by slavery. But the Republican Party of Abe Lincoln lasted less than 20 years. And then it got taken over by the robber barons, and that was the end of that. I mean, they just got co-opted just like the Democrats had been. And then we had a totally corrupt system all the way up until 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was elected. So, but, you know, your point is well made, Frank, and I appreciate it and well said. And we have to ask ourselves why. Why is it that conservative thinkers, why is it that thoughtful conservatives, actually intelligent people like William F. Buckley, I wrote about William F. Buckley in one of my books, I interviewed him once. Why is it that William F. Buckley, why is it that Bill Kristol, why is it that some of these folks, David Brooks, people who are, you know, they got an IQ that's above room temperature and a good education, why is it that they would endorse these kind of insane economic policies? There's a simple reason. There's a very simple reason. It goes all the way back to our first conservative president of the United States, John Adams. The simple reason is keep the people in their place. Stop the rabble from rabbling. During the two periods of a strong middle class in the history, in the 231-year history of this country, there have been two periods when there was a strong middle class. One was in the 1770s. The other was in the 1970s. What happened during both of those periods? People went out in the streets with guns. People started protesting. People were putting up pamphlets. People were challenging authority. Conservatives don't like that. Conservatives look at that and go, this is a society in chaos. We can't have this. Well, how do you do that? How do you do away with the middle class having enough leisure time, having enough economic security, having enough stability that they feel safe going out and expressing their frustrations in public? How do you do away with that? You take away their economic safety. And that's why conservatives have been working so hard for so many years, arguably for 200 years, but, you know, certainly they've been quite successful over these last 30 years at destroying the American middle class, because the American middle class represents instability. Jefferson looked at this and said, this is a good thing. John Adams looked at it, at, you know, at the Revolution, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, other revolutions. Adams looked at that and said, I'm not sure this is such a good thing. I mean, John Adams, I'll give you this, he was a patriot. He was a lousy president, but he was a patriot early on. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, you look at their writings, you read what these guys said. The conservatives were very concerned about the rabble. John Adams invented the phrase, for all practical purposes, the rabble. He didn't want you and I to be able to vote. He certainly didn't want us electing our senators. Got it written into the Constitution that we couldn't elect our senators. That didn't happen until 1917, as I recall. Maybe it was 1919. Frank in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Frank.
Hello. Is it Frank Walter, did you say?
I beg your pardon?
You're talking to me. Okay.
I am, yeah.
You had another Frank on there, and I wanted to be sure. I was really intrigued by what you're talking about earlier with Ronald Reagan, and I made the comment to the gentleman that was on the phone that Roosevelt saved capitalism, and Reagan destroyed it for all practical purposes. And the very first act out of the gun for him was to take on the unions and for all practical purposes destroy them. Look what's happened to union membership. By the way, you mentioned Doonesbury.
Yeah.
And you should see the one today. It's a beauty on Iraq and what's going on. That they say since the surge has occurred, everything's a lot better. And he says, we're living in Syria.
You know? Yeah. You're absolutely
gone
right.
Gone out of the country.
Yeah, that was definitely a good one, Frank. But the one yesterday, was even better, and that was about how the Republicans, the only way that they're going to win is by preventing people from voting. I mean, you know, it takes us back to Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist, who just said it right out front. He was talking to a group of Republicans in a Christian church, and his Republican Christian activist base about how they had to stop people from voting.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yeah, there you go. 866-303-2270. Len, you want to disagree with me in New York City. What's up?
Well, you know, I think the underlying difference between all the elitists in the past who tried to, keep the average person from getting ahead, at their expense, and these last two three decades, is the big difference is even then they didn't consider that it was in the interest of this country to create massive deficits, since they couldn't come up with any money to pay for the tax cuts. They couldn't tax the lower income people. They just simply made up the story that these tax cuts pay for themselves. And that's basically the difference between how the others just took advantage and these guys have fundamentally destroyed our system.
Yeah.
To the point where we need another FDR to realign the entire, get a mandate to realign the entire system.
Yeah, Frank, very well said and spot on. Well said. John in Seattle. John, I got a minute here before the break. What's up? John?
Hello? Yeah, hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air. Hi, Tom. Basically, it's a little off topic, but I want to respond about last week before you went on your 4th of July break. You had two people that called about displaying the flag upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing that for quite a while also, and I've been getting some intimidation and harassment at work.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly could face some retaliation or discipline, yeah, as they call it.
Yeah.
The
flag, this is, I still hold to my opinion that this is something that is pretty, we're talking about, flags and crosses and things. These are very powerful symbols, and And I think that we deal with them with anything less than respect at our own risk, frankly. And I agree that our country's in a crisis, and I think probably a bumper sticker, if you want to do an exhibition, is a better way to respond, or stand out on the street corner with an impeach Bush sign. But getting politically active is the ultimate thing we need to do.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When all is said and done and all those other cliches, we have to bring this all back to the United States. We have to recognize that the conservative agenda is to destroy democracy and replace it with a kleptocracy, an autocracy, a rule by a small number of very, 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 very wealthy people who, by the way, reward their own very well. You might have noticed Limbaugh getting $400 million over the weekend. Yeah, that's the kind of money conservative commentators can make. Hannity on his way to $200 million. And so anyhow, they pay people working in these think tanks and things. They're doing very well. Progressive think tanks, they're out there. Progressive bloggers, I don't know any of them that are getting rich. I really don't. Arianna Huffington seems to be doing well, but she's actually running a business. But beyond that, I'm not seeing it. Speaking of businesses, our full Monty alert for the day. One woman may have found a solution to rising gas prices that doesn't involve a hybrid car, riding a bike, or any kind of new technology or alternative fuels. Angela Eversoll, 34-year-old from Kentucky, approached Kenneth Nowak and worked out a deal with him where he would give her a $100 Speedway gas card and she would give him, well, let's say she's facing prostitution charges. And another, this was in Kentucky. Here's another one that, this was in Kentucky. Here's another one in Arizona. Kelly Still bartered oral sex for gas money, but apparently in the last minute backed out and stabbed the guy with scissors. I don't know. That's right. Okay, you pay your money, you take your chances, I guess, in a big way. 866-303-2270. John in Miami, Florida. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you were discussing about George Bush, what their objectives. He uses the word objectives a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Where, let's say, Senior Bush. Let's go to Senior Bush and Gorbachev. When they were standing there, it was an ABC program. I actually showed like a briefing about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He had George Senior looking at Gorbachev saying, we both agree in a one-world government.
Right.
And I believe that when you talk about people who have money, these are the people that paid for this wall to be dropped in the Germany. And
yeah, that's, you know, the one world government is very simple. It's called the World Trade Organization. For
right,
years and years, conservatives were hysterical that it was the United Nations. The United Nations is all about world peace. The World Trade Organization is all about making sure that the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and all wealth and ultimately all resources on the planet are concentrated in the hands of a few thousand people and or institutions. We've got, 100 multinational corporations. 53 of the 100 largest economies in the world are now multinational corporations, no longer governments. And you've got a couple hundred multinational corporations that are wealthier than pretty much any country. And a few thousand individuals, actually, arguably probably a million or so individuals worldwide out of the 6.5 billion of us. About a million individuals who are controlling somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 80% of all the world's wealth. And you're spot right on, John.
Just a few more things, if you don't mind. What I was saying is that look at Obama today. What happened to his aircraft? People don't realize that the federal government, George Bush, ordered this, a smart box to be put in every plane, where they could take a hold of that plane and control its flaps and everything. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're messing with this guy. Say, look, we have control of you.
Yeah.
You want to pull the troops out of the Middle East?
Yeah, John.
Look what we could do to you.
I really don't think that they're doing it at the level of his airplane, although, you know, again, these guys, this Bush administration, they're so weird, I wouldn't put anything past them. But here's the interesting thing, and I want to get into this in our third hour, is that if the FISA bill, which will probably be voted on tomorrow in Congress, and you need to be calling, go to callcongress.org, and you can find all the toll-free phone numbers. It's just a page on our website. Get all the toll-free phone numbers for Congress at callcongress.org. And call your senators. Each of us has two, unless you live in Washington, D.C. Call your senators and say no to FISA, not just on the telecom immunity, but just on the whole damn thing. We have an existing FISA law. It is not expiring. What is expiring is the special deal that makes George Bush emperor. And what's so ironic is that if this legislation is passed, then George Bush will be able to intercept all the conversations that Barack Obama is having with his campaign staff and that his campaign staff are having with other Democrats all around the country without a warrant, and they'll never know about it. And you wonder why the Republicans are saying, gee, we got more than we even asked for. I mean, yeah. Lauren in Western Alaska. Hey, Lauren. Lauren? Nope, Lauren's gone. Okay, Dean in Pennsylvania. Hey, Dean.
Yeah, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, I think you're leaving some stuff on the table here about people voting.
Okay.
I mean, the economics obviously are going to, a lot of it's going to hinge on who gets in, on what happens.
I tie them together in as much as the Republicans want people who have an income over $100,000 or $200,000 to be sure to be able to vote, and people who are broke, people who are having a hard time, people who are facing hard times, not to be able to vote. That's what it's coming
exactly
down to.
Exactly. Well, they pass a law now where you have to have an ID. That needs to be taken care of now by anybody that needs it. That's just a hoop you have to jump through, which maybe can get changed later. People in a progressive church, get a church van. Take people to the polls. You say there's going to be Republicans there protesting voters. There should be Democrats there to unprotest the voters.
Yeah.
Take whatever.
The problem is you can't unprotest the voter. The challenge is actually the word.
Okay, unchallenge, or at least put up a fight for them.
Well, you can't. That's the problem. The only thing that the Democrats can do is they can challenge Republican voters. They can say, hey, you look too rich. I don't think you'll be able to vote. But I guarantee you that the guy who looks too rich is going to have his ID. And he is going to be living at the house where he was living because he hasn't been foreclosed. And that's why the Republican challenges at the polls are so effective and Democratic challenges at the polls are relatively ineffective. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
This is Tom Hartman.
And if you haven't figured it out by now, yeah, welcome back to our program, the second hour of our show. Allison Kasich is with us. She's the director of the Argall Silverman Center for Collegiate Studies at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.com, the website for the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative women's group. Allison, welcome to our program. Allison?
Hi, yeah.
Hey.
Sorry, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad to have you with us. You have written an op-ed piece over at townhall.com, which I think is very thoughtful, and it's very well written. It's called, the headline, D.C. Gun Ban Lift Empowers Women. And you're speaking specifically about the Supreme Court case, this 5-4 Supreme Court case, where the Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment actually, for the first time in American history, the Supreme Court ruled that the Second Amendment actually contains a right for individuals in America, as opposed to individuals associated with militias, to own weapons, to own guns and presumably, you know, at the very least, handguns and rifles. And you say this is a good thing. You want to riff on that for a moment?
Sure. I mean, I obviously think that there's a lot of good things that came out of that case. I was happy to see them take it so far as to actually define, you know, an individual right to bear arms, rather than, you know, just talking about the specific ban in D.C. But what I think is interesting, and what I try to do in my article, which people can read on the IWF website if they want to, is really the women's angle. You know, what does this mean for women in the city? And I think it's a tremendously positive thing for women. Just think of the simple fact that, you know, regardless of, you know, whether people think it's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, men and women are different, especially physically. You know, men are, on average, taller, stronger. Basically, you know, if you're going to get into a physical encounter with someone, you know, the man would, the man would have the upper hand. And that makes self-defense a very difficult and challenging issue for women. And I happen to be a firm believer that, I mean, the ultimate self-defense for a woman is, you know, to have a gun in the house and be able to protect you and your family, from an intruder. You know, even if that intruder is, you know, a lot bigger and stronger than you, the gun is basically, a gun can be a great equalizer in terms of home protection. So that's why I think this is a tremendous victory for the women of Washington, D.C.
And I would agree with you if the statistics indicated that that was actually the case. Isn't it true, though, that more children die from accidental murder, you know, gun murders, and more people die as a consequence of suicide if there's a gun in the home than are robberies stopped and people defending themselves?
You know, this is the issue where, regardless of where you are on the political, you know, on the issue, you can sort of find statistics that back up your part. And I think that's what makes having an open, honest debate about the topic really hard, because, you know, everyone has their own study that they point to the numbers, and it's basically a case of, you know, I believe this study, you believe that study, and a lot of times it is hard to tell what the actual numbers are. I think the
well, let's find a middle ground here then. Let's assume that there's studies on both sides. One piece of the D.C. gun ban was that it did allow people to have shotguns in their homes and rifles, but they had to be either unloaded and locked or disassembled.
Yeah, well, specifically a trigger lock, and not only kept unloaded but disassembled. And if a lot of people who maybe aren't a gun owner, you know, the first time I read that, I didn't. I've never seen a trigger lock or a disassembled shotgun. So, you know, what does that really mean? If you look at, and people can find this kind of stuff on YouTube, and just, you know, if you, you know, do a Google search, you can find out what this means. Basically, it renders the weapon completely useless. I mean, imagine you're at home in the middle of the night, and you can tell someone's breaking in, and you want to get, you know, your shotgun, which, you know, you're allowed to have, to, you know, scare them off. As a woman just did, I think a very positive news story at the end of June.
And in fact, this story that you use of Kristen Holbert is this 18-year-old who scared off an intruder. I want to get into that in just a second, but your point is that it's going to take so much time to put that shotgun together.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's going to take so much time to put it together that you can't use it. So, which brings us to the issue of, and you raise this in your article, which I find fascinating. You point out that states, I used to live in Vermont, for example. It's one of the states that you cite. And it was not at all uncommon to see people driving around with a shotgun or a deer hunting rifle and literally in the back of the pickup truck. I mean, that old stereotype is very, very real in Vermont. And I even saw in the small town we lived in for a while, I even saw people walking into town with a gun strapped to their leg. I saw one occasion. It was not uncommon for people to be carrying guns in their purses and in their jacket pockets, because there are no carry laws in Vermont. Anybody can carry a concealed weapon, period. You don't even need a permit.
Yeah,
buy a gun and stick it in your pocket.
Same thing in Virginia. I actually live in Northern Virginia, not Washington D.C. And one of the main reasons that I made that living decision was that, I mean, that it is just tremendously safer in Virginia, and I don't think it's a far stretch to, like, a big reason because of that is that people can defend themselves, and criminals know that people, you know, if you're going to rob a home, there might be a gun inside.
Well, I would argue that it really goes a step beyond that, and because the states that you list, and you go through, you know, you talk about Utah and you talk about Vermont, and the states that you list are by and large states that are relatively rural. You say Vermont, New Hampshire, the Dakotas have the lowest murder rate in Utah, North Dakota, and Iowa. Firearm death rates below the national average. These are states where there's not massive poverty. Shouldn't, I would submit to you that the biggest problem that Washington, D.C. has is not whether or not people have guns. And introducing more guns into Washington, D.C. is not going to make the situation better. It's probably, in my opinion, going to make it worse. That the problem that Washington, D.C. has is that there is no economic base for that city. That for about a 30-year period back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in the United States, well, even before that, actually, going back from the Great Depression, it was one of the few cities where African Americans could flee, where federal anti-discrimination, anti-violence, anti-lynching laws were actually enforced. And so you've got a lot of people who are basically refugees from the South, and there's no work for them. And so we have this terrible poverty problem in Washington, D.C., and that's spawning a whole generation of problems from, you know, to unwanted children, teen pregnancies, drug use, an underground economy, and along with that underground economy is going to come, just like John Dillinger and his guns and during Prohibition in Chicago, you're going to have gun violence. And shouldn't we be, instead of arguing about whether or not people should have access to guns, shouldn't we be trying to figure out what to do about poverty in America?
Oh, sure. And I mean, it's not as if guns is the only variable that matters. I mean, you're touching on the fact that the problems we see in, especially inner cities, are tremendously complicated and they get tied back to the education system.
I'm suggesting that it's a hyper minor variable. I mean, if you look at Canada, look at Toronto and Montreal. You know, cities that I've spent a fair amount of time in. You've got large cities, but where they don't have the kind of grinding poverty that we have in the United States. Everybody has health care. They have a strong social safety net system. And you don't have the kind of gun violence that we have here, even though in Canada more people own guns per capita than in the United States.
Well, I think that there's a lot of I don't think that's necessarily a very – I think the economy – Canada is so different from America when you get down to on just a tremendous amount. I'm not sure that.
Yes and no. Montreal is 15 miles from the United States. Toronto rather. And it's right across the border. It's a major city. When we lived in Vermont, we used to drive up there all the time just for dinner. And I would say culturally, yeah, there's some differences, but they're not huge.
Well, not even just a cultural difference.
But they're not poor.
Public policy. No, certainly. I mean, but I think in a certain sense that, you know, comparisons are always nice, but in a sense that it kind of can distract you from the actual issue at hand. And especially looking at Washington, D.C., I mean, I think the question on everyone's mind was going into this, you know, big Supreme Court case, you know, was this gun ban a success or not? And I think universally, regardless of people who, you know, are really like gun, you know, even people who don't like guns, who are big gun control supporters. I mean, I think you take, if, you know.
The gun ban in Washington, D.C. was not working.
Completely a disaster.
It was not working. I agree with you, because you had a bunch of surrounding states like Virginia, where you live, where anybody could buy a gun and just walk into Washington, D.C. with it. There's not border guards there, number one. And number two, it didn't address the core problem, which is poverty.
So I agree with you on the poverty factor. I think that's probably a much more...
So why aren't conservatives putting their efforts on stopping poverty rather than promoting guns?
Who's to say you can't do both?
Come on, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, Allison.
I don't know, I'm not very coordinated. I might fall down if I try that. But listen, think about the... I think the lesson to learn from this case is, you know, and this isn't the end all be all in terms of, you know, what gun can, you know, in terms of the gun control debate. This is going to go on. There's already some new bills looking to continue to ban handguns in Washington, D.C. But the point that we should learn from this is that a ban doesn't work. If you ban guns, only criminals will have them, and you're still going to have gun violence. Except you.
I agree. The same thing is true of banning. I agree. The same thing is true of banning abortion. The same thing is true of banning pot. You know, bans don't work, and the ban on guns doesn't work. So let's deal with the root causes like poverty. Allison Kasich, IWF.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Your radio support group for We the People.
Traffic and bitch while we wait, pissed at the world for for making us late. We punch in, then lunch it, then punch out again. Rush home to clean up the messes we left. Microwave dinner, then put it to bed. Tomorrow we'll do it all over again. That's just a day.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you supporting our sponsors and in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more over at Teamster.org. Okay, let me just redefine this. And here's my position with regard to gun control and what I think is a rational position. First of all, I've lived in countries where guns have been illegal. I've lived in countries where guns were widely available. I've lived and worked in countries where guns were a major problem, like Colombia down in the Medellin Valley or in Bogota, and in countries, as I said, where guns were illegal. I've worked. I haven't lived in the UK. I lived in Germany. Guns are very, very hard to legally own there. You have to prove that you're actually a sports, either a hunter or a. Actually, there's a lot of hunting guns there. A fair amount of hunting goes on, but pistols are very, very hard to prove that you have, you know, that you just work on a shooting range kind of thing. But the bottom line is pretty straightforward. When I lived in Vermont, there were no restrictions at all. In Portland, Oregon, I'm not sure what the laws are. In this city, I'm quite sure you need a permit to carry. Rural areas, I don't know. But the bottom line, I think, is that every community should be able to make its own decision. I'm not somebody – now, with regard to things like 50-millimeter rifles, you know, a rifle that can fire an armor-piercing bullet that can take out a jetliner from a mile away, I have a problem with that. Surface-to-air missiles, I have a problem with that. But a hunting rifle or a gun that can be used for self-protection, self-defense, a basic stick-it-in-your-purse gun or whatever – under appropriate circumstances, I don't have a problem with that. I do think that there is an argument to be made for the reason that we require people to get a license, and the purpose of the license is to prove competency. The reason that we have people prove competency to drive a car is because it's 5,000 pounds of steel flying down the road at 60 miles an hour that can cause death and destruction. Now, a car actually has as its primary purpose transportation. A gun has as its sole purpose killing things. So you would think all the more important that if somebody is going to have a gun, that they at least demonstrate the competency in using it. And this is the kind of legislation that I would think that the NRA should be supporting to the extent that they could be, you know, one of the certifying agencies. And in fact, they do that. The NRA does offer very good programs in gun safety and competent, reasonable gun ownership. But I support Vermont's right to say we're not going to have any laws about this outside of, you know, machine guns and things. And on the other hand, I support New York City or Washington, D.C.'s right to say we're going to ban all of them. You can't have them here. And I recognize how difficult it is to enforce. But I think that the real issue, when you look at America versus all the other industrialized countries, ranging from Canada, where they have more guns per capita than we do, to Denmark, where Louise and I just were, where it's against the law to own a gun, unless you can prove that you're a collector or a sportsman of a particular type, that it really isn't about guns. It's really about poverty. It's really about economic opportunity. All these other industrialized countries in the world, all of them, if you get sick, you don't have to worry about falling into bankruptcy. If you are hungry, you can get food. If you are homeless, you can get shelter. If you are unemployed, there's unemployment insurance. There's a social safety net. But that social safety, and there is good, high-quality, free education all the way up to and through college. So there's a high level of social mobility. So you don't have people trapped in ghettos for generation after generation after generation. You don't, by and large, obviously, you know, to a certain extent, this list, but you don't have the driving factors that drive crime, and in an environment of easy guns, gun crime. Now, that's not to say that none of these countries have crime. Obviously, all of them do. But nothing like the United States. We have more people in prison than any other country in the world, both in absolute numbers and per capita numbers. Something's wrong. Could it have something to do with the fact that Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it? That the whole idea of I am my brother's keeper, the whole idea of let's work together to provide at least a social safety net, the old the Republicans rewriting the bankruptcy laws, that yes, we want to encourage you to step out and start a business and be an entrepreneur and take a chance, and if you fail, we will catch you. You can declare bankruptcy and start over, as Henry Ford did 7 times. That those American ideals need to be recaptured. That we didn't have the kind of gun violence in the 50s and 60s and 70s that we're having now. In part for these reasons. Maybe these are the issues that we should be talking about in the context of gun control. 27 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Larry Craig scares me, the senator from Idaho. All his Republican buddies are telling him he's gotta go. You see, they think that being gay is some kind of disgrace. All around the Senate and the House, they make that case. The fact is, it got enormous closet space, and that scares me. Dick Cheney scares me with those beady eyes. They get intense and glary every time he lies, which is like every day now. He's got a machine where his heart should be, just pumping out an evil philosophy. He shoots people in the face and gets away scot-free, and he scares me. Coulter scares me, and now I gotta be blunt. In my frank opinion, she's just a stupid pundit. And in the time of my day, she isn't worth the tick, 'cause she's nothing but a carny with a hate-filled shtick. But she sold a couple million books, and that's just sick. She scares me. But wait a minute, the Democrats scare me. Up there on Capitol Hill.
Uh-oh.
Won't do what's necessary.
He said it.
And probably never will.
Well, maybe.
Casper Milquetoast.
Maybe. Enough of us get involved. See, that's the key. 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. Rick, a devoted listener. Says he's got, I gotta say he's straight about Canada and guns. He says, Canada may have more guns per capita, but they're all registered, majority hunting rifles and shotguns. The U.S. has the largest amount of unregistered firearms in North America. And he also said if you lived in Vermont, you weren't going to Toronto, you were going to Montreal. You're right. Although we lived in Detroit, our oldest daughter was born in Detroit. I grew up in Michigan. And so we used to go to Toronto all the time, just go across from Windsor and over to Toronto. And so I've spent a lot of time in both cities, and I'm mixing them up in my brain here. But thanks for setting me straight, Rick. Much appreciated. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, I have another layer to this issue, and it really comes out of the experience of seeing reports from Louisiana where people were rousted out of their homes and their guns were taken away from them by the authorities. And I'd like to read the following statement. The right to own guns is a civil right.
Mark, hang on. We don't do reading here on the show, but you're welcome to express your opinion.
You want to impose censorship?
I beg your pardon?
You want to impose censorship on me? You want to let me finish?
Yeah. I'm going to impose censorship. People call all the time and say, I've got this poem I want to read. I've got a speech I want to read. No, we don't do reading on the show. I'm sorry. Ed in Orange County, California. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I usually agree with you on everything. I buy your books. I like listening to you. But you're absolutely wrong. Because,
okay.
Well, you're right about, yes, we need to reduce poverty. But you see, please don't take me wrong. You're richer than I am. I've had my house try to be broke into next door neighbors to mine three times in the last week. If I don't have something to protect me, Tom, and my family, I'm totally lost. You see, I don't have
a lot of money. I'm not saying you shouldn't, Ed.
I don't have a lot of money, Tom.
Ed, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a gun.
Huh?
I'm not saying you shouldn't have a gun.
Well, it sounds like it.
No, what I was saying is, and I'll repeat it again, I lived in Vermont where anybody could have a gun under any circumstances, and I think that's just fine. And in New York City, where the majority of the people in New York City got together and said, you know, we don't want to have any guns in there in our city, and so they passed really strong regulations. You can have a gun for your own protection in New York. You just have to jump through some hoops. You got to prove you know how to use the thing. You got to get a license, et cetera. And I approve of that. I think that this should be up to local communities, how tightly or loosely they want to regulate handguns. I think it's a local issue. At the federal level, I think it should be, yeah, okay, bazookas, you know, mortars, rocket launchers, air, you know, surface-to-air missiles, 50-millimeter machine guns, things like that. I have no problem with federal regulation of those. But handguns and hunting weapons, hunting guns, I think it should be up to the local community. And I think if you live in a local community that says that it's legal for you to own a gun, I totally support you in doing that.
No, they don't want me to own a gun.
Well, then move to another community.
I just said I was poor. I could pick up. If I could, I would, Tom.
So you're going to find yourself, Ed, if your only means of protection is to have an illegal gun and you use that thing, you're going to find yourself in jail.
Yeah, I know. That's why I had to go out and buy a taser gun last week.
Okay, well, there's an alternative, and pepper gas. I mean, there's a lot of non-lethal alternatives as well as guns, by the way. But Ed, thanks for the call. I get your point. I think we went a bit far afield here. But Dennis and Eugene, hey Dennis, what's up?
Yeah, you know the scary part is, and this is all liberals. You is that you're willing to trash our Constitution. The Constitution of the United States says we are allowed to have guns. The founding fathers were worried about a tyrannical government, and you know politicians need to be reminded every once in a while that their populace has the means and the will to overthrow a tyrannical government, and that's why they put it in our Constitution.
Okay, so three points here, Dennis. You're making
that.
You're making multiple points. Let's deal with them one at a time. First of all, up until 2 weeks ago, there was not a consensus that the United States Constitution said that we have an individual right to own guns. It was that if you're the founding fathers said that a well-regulated militia being essential to the security of a free state, the right of an individual to own a gun shall not be. I beg your pardon?
You left out a sentence. The right of the individual.
I was in the middle of that sentence when you interrupted me, pointing out that I had left it out. The right of an individual to hold a gun shall not be constrained, or whatever the exact language is. But you're absolutely right. But it was in that context, and there has been a debate in this country for 231 years. That debate has been resolved by a 5-4 Supreme Court decision.
Thank God.
The Supreme Court said there's an individual right to own guns. Now the question becomes, just as you have an individual right to say anything you want. But that right has limits. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You know, you can't shout down George W. Bush on a 4th of July ceremony without getting dragged out. I mean, we have free speech rights, yet those are constrained. We have gun rights, yet those are constrained, and they will be constrained. So the question is, at what level do those rights get constrained? Number one. And number two, the second point that you brought up is we all need to have guns in order to fight back an oppressive government. That's a nice romantic notion, Dennis. It was not the idea of the founders.
Go back and read their writing. What's the first thing Hitler did?
The first thing that Hitler did was he caused a broad consensus among Germans that the economic disasters that they were experiencing were being caused by an economic elite that he identified as the Jews.
He registered and rounded up their guns.
No, that wasn't the first thing he did. That was way, 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 way down the list. And in fact, he actually passed out a whole lot more guns than he took because he conscripted every single man. He was conscripting 13-year-olds at the end of World War II.
Read on the air, but I'd like to read what Thomas Jefferson said about guns. I mean, all of the founding fathers meant for individuals to keep and bear arms. Now, the point
Jefferson loved his gun. You know, he wrote a letter to his nephew about how every day he took a 2-hour walk in the morning and he carried a gun with him. He thought it was a great thing to do. You know, they were different times, but even Jefferson never thought that individuals owning guns would forestall a tyranny in the United States. If George Bush tomorrow morning said, okay, that's it, I'm ending the elections, I'm going to take over this country, we're going to send in the Black Hawk helicopters and Halliburton and Blackwater and everybody else, and they're going to take over your community, do you really think, Dennis, that with your SIG 45 or your you know, whatever it may be, that you're going to be able to stand out in the street and stop those guys?
I just think, you know, you said here's the bottom line. And no, the bottom line is that we live in a country where the Constitution demands that we have this right. If you don't like it, move to a country that doesn't.
And every right that we have exists within certain limits. As I said, you know, the example of free speech and the right to...
They're willing to eliminate the ones they don't like. You know, that's what's scary about Obama presidency.
Conservatives are willing to eliminate the ones they don't like the right to privacy. But, you know, rather than calling names at each other, Dennis, which is, you know, ultimately a pretty pathetic way to have an argument, tell me how it is that having reasonable limits on the right to own guns, which we both agree is now established law in the United States, how that is a bad thing.
Well, I've got 13 guns, and not one person's ever been harmed by any of them. And number one, you should know this, is that if somebody breaks into your house and they know that you're home, stand by, because they're prepared to kill you. You know, most people that break into homes, they run if they think somebody's home. But if somebody continues breaking into your home...
Well, and there's one argument that they're more prepared to kill you if they know that you're armed.
Even though he knows you're there, you better stand by to kill him, because he's going to kill you. I mean, that's just the police will tell you that.
Which is bringing me back to my original point, which is what kind of an incredible... Dennis, thank you for your call. What kind of an insane culture have we created where we live in fear in our homes? I mean, I just have this vision of Bush going, you know,
be afraid, be very afraid.
We've got all these Americans living in terror in their homes, holding on to their guns, going, okay, this is it. This is the thing that's going to save my life. Not realizing that that in other countries, they don't deal with these issues by and large. I mean, this is not that big a problem in most. Why? Because it's the economy, stupid. I mean, this is like we're looking at Chicago in the 1930s. My dad grew up in Chicago in the 1930s. He used to go down to one of John Dillinger's speakeasies and get beer for his dad, for my grandfather. He told us stories about that. Those guys all had guns. Why? Because they were criminals. Why? Because you had prohibition. That was their... You had a Great Depression. They couldn't get a job. What job did they get? They got the job of selling bootleg booze. It was all about an economic disaster and prohibited substances. That's the exact same thing that we have now. We have an economy that doesn't work.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hard every day, not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than they're paid, and it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time to work a 40-hour week for a living. Just send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh, steel mill worker, let me thank you for your time.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. We'll be getting back to your calls as we continue. And just a reminder, our next hour, I really want to devote that hour to our this FISA legislation, the whole issue of privacy. And we're going to start out with Barry Siegel, who has written a new book called Claim of Privilege, this whole secrecy privilege used by the Bush administration. So stick around. Right now, Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. As you know, speaking of FISA, tomorrow is the is where it really takes place in the Senate. And they're expected to sort of do debates and then do amendments and whatever. I'm not very hopeful on this at all.
Yeah, neither am I. But that doesn't mean that we don't make it, you know, give it our very best effort.
No, we got to give it the old college try. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's interesting that maybe you've been talking about this, Mr. al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraqi, said that his government's actually considering passing a short-term memorandum of agreement with the U.S. Instead of that status of forces agreement. Mm-hmm. And he suggested that it may contain a formula mandating a phased withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
And,
now, for our listeners who don't know the backstory, let me just set this up real quickly, Ellen. When we invaded Iraq, we were in violation of the United Nations Charter and in violation of Resolution 1991 that said that there could be an invasion of Iraq, but only after Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei reported back to the UN and there was a Security Council vote. That never happened. So we invaded the country illegally. 6 months later, retroactively, sort of like the FISA law, retroactively, the Security Council voted to give us authority to go into Iraq. We were already there. And extended that authority until the end of the year of 2008. And on January 1st, 2009, and correct me if my dates are wrong on this, I think I have these right. On January 1st, 2009, our legal authority established by the United Nations to have even one soldier in the country of Iraq vanishes. So there has been this very, very rapid song and dance on the part of both the Bush administration and the Iraqi government to create a new agreement just between the two countries where Iraq as a sovereign nation basically invites the United States as a sovereign nation, sort of like Germany and the United States or Japan and the U.S., to have bases and military soldiers in their country. And the problem is that the Bush administration wants it to be forever and wants to have all these 17 bases and wants to have all this presence and wants to have all these companies and everything else. And the Iraqi government wants to make it very short-term.
3,000 people.
Right, yeah. And the Iraqi government is getting a lot of blowback from their people and a lot of internal political dissent. So the status of forces agreements, the so-called SOFA agreement, is the framework that's being used to come up with how we're going to stay in Iraq. And what I hear you saying right now is that Maliki is saying, forget the SOFA, we'll give you a short-term agreement. It sounds like basically Maliki is saying, okay, George, you want an agreement? You're going to have to take Barack Obama's plan.
Right, and he's just up the road from where I am now, in Abu Dhabi, where there are several prime ministers from around, the region that are meeting today.
Hmm. Oh, you're calling in from the Middle East today?
I am.
Oh, cool. You sound like you're
It's an interesting place here. Let's, put it that way, particularly because, I guess, I'm one of the people that, I've been emailing people, and I meant to send you a fairly long email, but I will today, about some of my thoughts about what's going on here. And, you know, I think I'm the lone ranger that really thinks that the United States possibly could go into Iran, you know, strategically with some bombs. And everybody else thinks I'm insane, but I trust my gut a little bit, I think.
Yeah. Now I remember a month or so ago, last time you were in Abu Dhabi, you said everybody there was convinced the U.S. was going to attack Iran at any moment. That has changed. That sentiment has changed.
Well,
on the street?
I'm talking about people in the United States.
Oh, I see. I see. I'm sorry. In Abu Dhabi, what do
they think? Anybody I talk to in the United States thinks I'm lost my marbles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't think I've lost
you and Cy Hirsch, right?
Right.
Cy has a pretty good track record, and so do you.
somebody I talked, I have a very close contact or a couple of close contacts within the White House, and so I emailed them and at their private email addresses, not through the White House email address, over the weekend, and was told basically the party line, Cy Hirsch is stirring things up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's always the party line, and Cy Hirsch is always right. So, and it has been ever since Watergate. So we'll see. What else is going on in the world?
Okay. Also, the president is at the G8 conference, and he met with the president of Tanzania, and then there are eight other African countries there with the what's called the Working Group on Africa, and they had a very tense, according to the pool reports, which we get, meeting today, and it was announced that they were going to take questions, but they didn't take questions. They just made statements. And the Tanzanian president said that they had disagreement on the way forward. And then he said in this cryptic way, you would have liked us, talking to the president, to do something, and we would have liked you to do something. And then basically let off at that point. But it looks like there was some great unhappiness, and this really has to do with the situation with Mugabe and what is happening on that front.
Interesting.
And he also is on a first-name basis with the new Russian president, and they're calling each other Dmitry and George, and say that they have many areas that they agree on, but they still disagree on the missile defenses.
Yeah, interesting. And that whole situation with Poland, it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. Helen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
This is Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The mysterious plane crash, the landmark Supreme Court case, and the rise of state secrets. It sounds like a novel. It actually reads like one in parts. Claim of Privilege. Barry Siegel is with us, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book, Claim of Privilege, about how, in many ways, our civil liberties have evaporated or are evaporating. Barry, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. Back in 1953, U.S. versus Reynolds, this first made, I mean, you know, John Adams actually claimed state secrets rights and threw people in jail under the Alien and Seditions Act for violating that in 1797, as I recall. But in 1953, this became a legal doctrine. Where are we at since then?
Well, you're absolutely right. The state secrets privilege didn't first just get created by the 1953 decision. It was in common law for a long time before that, but it hadn't been recognized formally or codified by the Supreme Court in this country, and there had been no procedures established for how really it works and what the rules were. That's what happened in 1953, the Supreme Court landmark decision, U.S. versus Reynolds, formally recognized the privilege for the first time and, most important, laid down rules for how it could be invoked by the government. It started very slowly. In fact, it was only invoked about five times in the first 20 years or so, 53 to 73. But it has sure accelerated since then. Around the 1970s is when the executive branch really started discovering the power that they had with this and started multiplying. The Bush administration by far has used it more than any other.
Now, the MacGuffin of your book, the kind of plot device, the thing that it revolves around is this B-29 crash. Tell us about that.
Right, a very mysterious
you know, I'm glad you said the book reads somewhat like a novel. What drew me to this book as much as the political issues is the fact that it is a fantastic tale with a lot of very interesting characters, and it starts with this mysterious plane crash. U.S. Air Force B-29 takes off October 1948 to test some secret navigational equipment. It was a precursor to the guided missile program, really. Three civilian engineers were on board. The plane engine catches fire. The plane crashes over Waycross, Georgia, October 6, 1948. The three civilian engineers perish, and their widows file suit claiming negligence against the United States government.
Right, and the government was claiming essentially, hey, this is, top secret military stuff. And at the end of the day, when they dug out through all the way through the bottom of the thing, it turned out that it was just, I realize I'm oversimplifying, and I hope I'm not giving away your book. I don't think I am at all.
Some of it's in the flap copy, I think.
Yeah, that essentially the government was just trying to make themselves look good. This is not unlike the case of, the Jessica Lynch story, or the Pat Tilney story, or whatever.
Exactly. In fact, it's really important to understand that, in fact, the government did not first try to claim state secrets at all in this case. What happened is the lawsuit is filed, and the widows, during discovery, request something pretty normal, the accident report, the Air Force accident report and witness statements. How else are they going to – all they're trying to do, they're not trying to get any state secrets. They're trying to establish what was the cause of the plane crash that killed their men. And when the government first refused to turn over the accident report, it had nothing to do with state secrets. They just said that it was an executive housekeeping privilege, that when they do an internal investigation, that they're allowed to keep that the results of that investigation to themselves. And to be honest, that was the argument for about the first year. They would not even, and this is really important, Tom, they would not even turn it over to the judge for private examination in the judge's chambers. They said that they had a unilateral right to withhold the document. That judge, very brave judge, William Kirkpatrick, federal district judge, sitting in the height of the Cold War, lots of pressures just like today, sense of apocalyptic danger from the Soviet Union, and yet he said, he stood up to the government and said, no way, you don't have that unilateral power. You've got to show me the documents. I'll look at them in chambers and decide whether they, in fact...
And the government did produce the documents, unlike right now, where you've got the Senate, the House of Representatives and the Senate both issuing subpoenas for Harriet Myers, Josh Bolton, Karl Rove, and in all cases, these members of the administration saying, sorry, you know, we have the right to, this is state secrets, we have the right.
Well, this is exactly this is why the story that I wrote that begins back there in the Cold War era resonates so much today, is because the Bush administration is using the legacy of the U.S. versus Reynolds and the state secrets privilege all the time now. But, you know, let's make clear, I want the listeners to understand, they did not turn over the documents back then. When Judge Kirkpatrick ordered them, first they said it was just an executive privilege, then they claimed it was state secrets. They started a year into the litigation to say, these documents contain national security state secrets. That's why we can't hold it over. The judge still insisted that they let him see. They refused to turn over the documents, and so Judge Kirkpatrick actually found in default against the government and awarded the widows what they were seeking.
Okay. So.
But then there was an appeal, another appeal, and it finally got to the Supreme Court.
Right. And at the Supreme Court, what happened?
At the Supreme Court, after two levels of judges had ruled in favor of the widows, U.S. Supreme Court, Fred Vinson was the Chief Justice, height of the Cold War, sense of danger all around them. In March 1953, they reversed the two lower court rulings and found in favor of the Air Force and the government, saying that they did, in fact, have a state secrets privilege and could withhold the documents, or that judges should not, to be more precise, the judges should not automatically request to see the documents if the government can prove to them an argument that there is a reasonable danger if those documents are exposed.
Yeah, this is like Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, or Buckley versus Viejo, as it relates to the rights of voters and dollars in the political process. Or I was going to say Bush v. Gore, but that's actually not supposed to relate to anything. But,
right.
But
I don't know what that meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Or this, any number of recent cases.
The cases rise. What happens is that at the start there's a balancing act here. It says don't ask to see the documents if they can prove to you that there's reasonable danger. But this is like asking judges to fly blind. How right. can you know if the documents really contain state secrets?
How does this tie? You know, for example, right now under the FISA legislation, my read of this FISA bill or right. this amendment to FISA, because FISA is fine, it's going to stay in place if this legislation is not passed. If this legislation is passed, then George Bush will have the authority, without going to a court, to wiretap Barack Obama's BlackBerry.
Right.
I don't get why the Democrats would say that that's an okay thing. And does that tie into the Sullivan case?
Well, it does. The Reynolds case, it does. You know, first of all, I don't get it either. I have no wisdom here why they rolled over on it, except that there were worse alternatives. Basically, I just was reading Obama's explanation for it, literally on a blog just before we started mm-hmm. our conversation, and a lot of this is a result of certain compromise that there was.
Yeah, but
worse
I think his explanation is disingenuous. You know, he says warrants are going to expire. Well, they're not warrants under FISA. They're under the legislation that gave Bush too much power.
Right. Well, I regret that. It's a puzzlement to me, too, Tom. It really is. I regret this, but it does absolutely, all of this arises from U.S. Reynolds. Because the underlying issue in the whole issue of U.S. versus Reynolds and state secrets privilege is really balance of powers, separation of powers in our system of government.
And it gives the power to the executive branch exclusively.
Exactly. Well, the executive branch, in a sense, seizes that power. The executive branch insists that it has that power unilaterally. That it's really revolutionary when you think about it. What the executive branch did in ever since U.S. versus Reynolds is not just say we have a certain right to do this, and it says once we make this claim, there is no right of judicial review at all. That the judges, it's that.
What do you think the chances are? We just have 20 seconds left. What do you think the chances are that U.S. versus Reynolds would be overturned?
Oh, I think that we'd just be dreaming about that. I think our best chance is to have conversations like this and throw a spotlight on it. The best chance is that they're going to pass some legislation to regulate the privilege.
To regulate the privilege. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. Claim of Privilege is the book. Mysterious Plane Crash, Landmark Supreme Court Case, and the Rise of State Secrets by Barry Siegel, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Barry, and the book is in bookstores now and, of course, online. Barry, thanks so much for dropping by.
Pleasure.
And a great job of writing you did. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Legislation passed during the Clinton administration to release 1 million secret files on the assassination of John Kennedy. They're not releasing them. They're not releasing files on the assassination of Martin Luther King. They're not basically releasing anything. They are classifying information at a rate that is unprecedented. In the meantime, as the government is seizing, our government is seizing more and more information about us. And this is, you know, just dramatically extensive how far this goes. I mean, back in 2005, the New York Times broke this story about domestic surveillance. Dee Parm wrote a great blog about this, a great post about this over at the Daily Kos, dailykos.com. It's titled How Domestic Surveillance Affects You and Me. And the essential point of it is this has something to do, arguably, with terrorists and criminals, but a lot to do with just average people. For example, the data mining sweeps include things like where you're using your credit cards. And where you're using your credit card. For example, are you going to a marriage therapist and paying for it with a credit card? You ever been to a massage parlor and paid for it with a credit card? Have you ever gone to an online porn site or an online gambling site and paid for it with a credit card? That information becomes the property of the credit card companies. Now, A, it could be swept up by the government and used against you. B, perhaps, frankly, in my opinion, even more ominous. And those are the more extreme examples. I mean, who knows? But it could be used by the private companies themselves. They could sell it to data banks. And this, in fact, is happening. They could sell it to data banks where other private companies, say, for example, insurance companies, want to decide whether or not they're going to insure you based on what they call lifestyle risk factors. Like, does he spend money in bars? How often does he spend money in bars? Fill in the blank. I already gave you some of the other examples. And, Deep Harm writing about this over at the Huffington Post, they talk about how in the 1950s, this was used. What they did was they tracked down people. The Department of Justice under J. Edgar Hoover would get the economic information about individuals that they thought had communist leanings. They would share that information with employers and basically make these people unemployable. They say, now this is going on, there's an ongoing lawsuit, this from the Post, against the credit card firm CompuCredit. And he says, Deep Harm says, this gives us a glimpse of what the future holds in store. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, claims that CompuCredit didn't properly disclose that it monitored spending and cut credit lines if consumers use their cards at certain places. Now, this is a real company that really did this, according to this claim by the Federal Trade Commission. Among them, tire and retreading shops, massage parlors, bars, billiard halls, and marriage counseling offices. This company used the information, apparently, according to this FTC complaint, to come up with a score about how creditworthy you were to determine how much they're going to charge you for access to credit. And that score then becomes part of your credit record, which determines whether or not you can even buy a house or a car. CompuCredit, this from the story, story about it. CompuCredit maintains that the Federal Trade Commission's lawsuit is without merit. This is from Business Week, I'm quoting, and defends its practices, saying, and this is a quote from the company, these scoring models are commonplace across the industry. So here now we have the House Resolution 6304, the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. And what Deep Harm is suggesting is that the biggest threat that this holds is that it further erodes our rights of privacy. Not just, doing away with the Fourth Amendment. Let's remember what the Fourth Amendment says. I mean, the Fourth Amendment is one sentence. It's one sentence. Now, they didn't use the word privacy back in 1787 when they wrote the Constitution, or 1789 when they wrote the Bill of Rights. They didn't use the word privacy because privacy back in those days meant toilet functions. Most houses didn't even have toilets within them. They had them separate from the house. And a person would say, excuse me, I need a moment of privacy. And that was code for I have to go to the toilet. Because the word toilets hadn't been invented for all practical purposes. Thomas Crapper popularized the flush toilet in the 1880s. We're talking about the 1780s, 100 years earlier. The word privacy meant toilet functions. You won't find it in the writings of any of the founders. But they knew what they were talking about when they said, and I quote, the right of the people to be secure in their homes, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. In other words, your home is your castle, your communications are your own, your privacy is your own damn business, and if the government's going to look into it, and I would argue that if a corporation is going to look into it, they damn well better go before a judge and say there's some reason for this. There is some probable cause that a crime has been committed that justifies this intrusion.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Republicans, too. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I'll tell you, strange things are going on out there in the world. Just absolutely strange things. For example, a combative cat named Lewis, who frightened his neighbors and got his owner into legal trouble 2 years ago, has done so well under house arrest that they've set aside his case. He's no longer on probation. He's now an indoor pet, only allowed outside in a cat carrier. Yeah. He drew widespread attention in 2006 when his owner opted for a trial on the criminal charge rather than euthanize or declaw him. A tip of our hat to the owner of Lewis, whose name is, Ruth Cicero, who said, "No, I ain't taking his claws. I ain't killing him. And we'll turn him into a decent cat." That, you know, this is just like Higgins, our cat Higgins. When our son Justin gave us this cat that he had rescued from this dorm or frat house at the University of Georgia. And the cat was nuts. Or was it the University of Vermont? I forget where he was living at the time. But in any case, the cat was plain old flat out nuts. It had been locked in the bathroom for days at a time. It had figured out that the only way to get water was to stand underneath the shower with its mouth open and hope for drip, 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 which is to this day, Higgins is in our shower half the time waiting for the water to come on, and lived on a diet of potato chips and pizza. There was a pit bull in the house, and they used to sick the pit bull on the cat. The cat got so aggressive it would take out the pit bull. When they got upset with the cat, they'd throw him against the wall. This is all as a kitten. So we get this kitten, and we put him in our bedroom, and we walk in, and he comes flying across the room and attacks us. For the first 6 months we had him, the only way we could get in to see him was to put leather gloves on. I kid you not. We had to wear leather gloves. And finally, after about a year, Higgins has turned into just, we've had him now for 5 years. Higgins turned into just one of the sweetest cats ever. In fact, the biggest problem I have now is getting him off the bed at night, because he wants to sleep with us every night and say, "No, Higgins, sorry," because in the middle of the night he wakes up wanting to rub his face against mine. He's become Mr. Friendly to Louise and I. Anybody else who comes into the house, though, he reverts to Pitbull. He's right back, totally crazy. So he is definitely an indoor cat. But anyway, that's our crazy alert for the day. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, a lot on the table, a lot of things we've talked about. By the way, a couple of quick points that I just want to make here before we finish the show. And, we have another 20 minutes to go. We'll be taking your calls. But this from the New York Times last October, Scott Shane's article. The phone company Quest Communications refused a proposal from the NSA that the company's lawyers considered illegal in February of 2001, 7 months before 9/11. Okay, so every time, this is from the New York Times, October 14, 2007, you can look it up, you can track it down. Every time you hear about this story, it's all, well, after 9/11, the Bush administration started spying. No, the Bush administration started spying as soon as they came into office. Bush was sworn into office in January, and Quest said no to the request in February of 2001, right after Bush was installed in office by the Supreme Court. I'm telling you, this is about political spying. It had nothing to do with terrorists. We know that the Bush administration they didn't even give a damn about terrorists. The guy came down to Washington or down to Crawford to tell George that bin Laden was going to attack the United States. And George said, "Okay, you've covered your butt. Go back to Washington, D.C. and send him away." They are spying on the Democrats. They've already been busted. You had a guy working out of Orrin Hatch's office who was reading Ted Kennedy's computer for over an hour. He confessed to it. He got fired for it. This is that on steroids. You think George Bush wouldn't do this? Give me a break. And now you've got Google has been ordered by a federal judge to turn over its records of its users. Have you watched a YouTube video since 2005? If you have, your name and your IP address and your personal information, to the extent that you might have given it to YouTube if you joined, is in that database. And a federal judge says they had to hand, says, got to hand it over to Viacom. So the question, what's Viacom going to do with it? The bigger question is, what the hell is Google doing with it? And how could it be used? And what happens when George Bush goes to them and says, well, you know, I'd like that information because we want to know if anybody's looking at terrorist YouTubes. And it's just like the thing, the airports coming into, or the computers coming into the country. They are stopping now. There's a whole huge scandal around this. A number of business organizations quite upset because the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, as people are coming, or Customs Service, as people are coming back into the United States, Americans coming back into the United States, they're taking their computers away. And in some cases, keeping them for months. They're demanding passwords and things like that so that they can get into them. And they're searching them for, they say, terrorist secrets. So far, all they've done is they've busted a couple of dozen people on kiddie porn and related charges. But they say they're looking for terrorist secrets. What else might be they looking for? Might they be looking for political things where they don't bust people? They simply gather the information. What's going on? What kind of country is this becoming? When are we going to wake up from this stuff? Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you, and I think this ties, actually, I didn't expect it to, but I think it ties in, because I think they're blackmailing Nancy Pelosi. I got an email today from the Alabama people who are the big supporters of Don Siegelman, and according to them, they have a firm confirmation that Nancy Pelosi is urging the Judiciary Committee not to go forward with contempt against Karl Rove. He's supposed to appear Thursday. So there's some infighting against the Democrats, apparently, on that committee. But if she's telling them not to do that, she's never in our corner anymore. I would love it if maybe you could get Don Siegelman on tomorrow and talk about this and get people to make phone calls.
Yeah, we'll check with Don and see if he wants to come on. It's a very good idea, Marilyn. Thank you very much. And thank you for the call. Let me lay out my personal conspiracy theory on this. I was having a conversation over the weekend with a good friend of mine who runs one of the largest progressive websites in the country, and we were speculating, why is it that Pelosi and the Democrats, and for that matter, even Barack Obama, would go along with a FISA bill that they know will not stand at least any kind of rational Supreme Court scrutiny? It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Why would they do that? It can't be, you know, why is Jay Rockefeller all of a sudden in favor of this thing when he used to be historically so pro-Fourth Amendment? It can't be the $18,000 in contributions that he got. Jay Rockefeller's richer than God. It can't be all the Democrats who voted for the FISA bill had on average about twice the contributions from the telco companies. And yes, the telco companies spent about $15 million lobbying on this for this thing in the weeks heading up to its vote in the House of Representatives 2 weeks ago. But I don't believe that that's it. It's not enough money. And, you know, maybe there's the economic argument being made, you know, that the telco companies, if these lawsuits are allowed to go forward, these class action lawsuits, it's going to be like the tobacco deal. These five phone companies are going to end up like the six or seven big tobacco companies, and in that they're going to owe hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. Or the other theory is that it's going to go up the chain, and not only are we going to discover all the crimes of the Bush administration, but we're going to discover the crimes of the people, the Democrats, who were on the intelligence committees who went along with this. Well, that one makes a little more sense. That Jane Harmon doesn't want us to know what she was up to, and that Nancy Pelosi's covering up for her. I mean, that makes a little more sense. But then you get into the realm of the really weird. And all you have to do to say to yourself, this isn't all that weird, is remember what Richard Nixon did. Richard Nixon was wiretapping Democrats. For years, he was wiretapping Democrats. Orrin Hatch, out of his office, had a guy breaking into Ted Kennedy's computer and getting private emails among Democrats about their strategy for the ratification, the appointments of federal judges, and what the Democratic strategy was going to be to oppose these federal judges that the administration had put forward. And the, and Kennedy and the Democrats, they couldn't figure out how did this happen. Is it possible? Is it possible that what's really going on is that the Bush administration has been using this power that they claimed in February of 2001, long before 9/11, virtually the moment that they took power, to get all the telephone records, all the economic records of every member of Congress, and you've got a whole bunch of members of Congress who have who would, if all of their secrets were laid bare, and many of them may be relatively innocent. You know, somebody likes to look at porn, but, you know, the titles of the porn are kind of scary, so they don't want to see the title in the New York Times. Might be totally legal, but, you know, or that they've been to a massage parlor, or that they've been, I mean, you know, you look at what has happened with David Vitter and Larry Craig and how they've been turned into national jokes. And the guy down in Florida, I'm forgetting his name, who, you know, was IMing the kids, who ultimately had to leave. I mean, he had to, you know, leave office as a consequence of that. You look at those things, and is it possible? We know that J. Edgar Hoover kept files on everybody. We know that J. Edgar Hoover was blackmailing Richard Nixon. We know that J. Edgar Hoover was blackmailing LBJ. And the record is quite clear on that. The book Private and Confidential, Anthony Summers' book Private and Confidential, it lays it all out. This is no secret. Is it possible that the Bush administration, maybe even Karl Rove himself, using these illegal wiretaps, is blackmailing the Democratic leadership?
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
With you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and your thoughts on all these issues we've been talking about. Kyle in San Rafael, California. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Tom. I think you're absolutely right about the spying thing. I think that they probably have the goods on the Democrats. Most people have something that they're ashamed of. Before I go on,
even something perfectly legal. I mean, it could be that Nancy Pelosi's husband was fooling around and she doesn't want it known, or God only knows. I mean, you know, it could be, you know, who knows?
It's just logical to me. It's human nature. I want to mention Fire Dog Lake. The theme of your program is get active. Well, if you go to firedoglake.com, there is a FISA dialing for the rule of law article, just a couple articles down, scroll down a little bit, and it's all there. You can use a call tool to help you get in touch with senators regarding the FISA bill. We've got a couple hours left today. I urge everybody who's concerned about this FISA bill to get on the phone and let them know. This is our last chance to show who we are. And we do not, we've got to remember, this is why they got rid of Nixon. Even the Republicans had had enough of him, and they went up there and they told him, you've got to resign or you're going to be impeached, bub. And yeah. This is the
same. Well, the same thing happened with and that's the reason why LBJ ended up not running for re-election, too, was because the Democrats sat him down and said, sorry, Charlie, ain't going to happen. Good one. Fire Dog. In fact, I just checked it out, and you're right. FireDogLake.com. Jane Hampshire's a great website, or I don't know if she owns the site, but she's, you know.
These folks here, Feingold, Leahy, and Dodd, they are our heroes. We have got to support them in this effort. Show your support. Call them. Say thank you. And call the people who are wavering or will vote against and let them know You can't do this to us. This right. is not only unconstitutional, it's immoral.
Right. I spent a lot of time Friday on Hillary Clinton's website, on her congressional website, clinton.senate.gov, trying to figure out what her position was on this. I didn't see anything. I'm going to have to probably give a call. But, Kyle, we need to find out where do our senators stand on this and tell them, please, defend the Fourth Amendment. Thank you very much, Kyle, for the call. I do appreciate it. 866-303-2270, Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon.
Hi. I'm sorry, but this goes way back to the first hour
and okay.
economics. But I'm not a great economics student. I just bought Ravi Batra's book, The New Golden Age.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who is a history buff, and she claims that the Great Depression had absolutely no economic reason to happen, that it was all based on panic by the populace. And I'm seeing here in just on page 16 of his book that there was the crash of the balloon, the first balloon of the
it was a bubble. It
or
was
a bubble.
And
yeah.
and you know your friend's argument is simply wrong. You can track these bubbles back. The most famous historical one was the Dutch tulip bulb bubble in the late 1400s, early 1500s, as I recall, where people were paying as much as $17,000 for a tulip bulb, you know. And
well, she was almost intimating that the only thing that would cause a depression now would be a big panic, you know.
Right. Well, see, what happens is when you have a bubble, when you have artificially inflated values, the values of things are much higher than they really appropriately should be. The prop gets pulled out from underneath that bubble. In the case of the dot-com bubble, you know, it was arguably this belief, this theology that you could have a company, that the internet was the next big thing that was going to make everybody rich, and you could have a company that never even made money, but nonetheless, you could make a fortune on it and the stock value would be high. When people realized that that particular emperor had no clothes, everybody started fleeing from it. And so then, you know, because we now have this bubble economy and the economy is just basically based on having a series of bubbles, because we don't make anything in the United States anymore. This is the result. I mean, this is, you know, Greenspan brought this about. This is the result of Reaganomics. So all this money had to go to someplace. So Greenspan is like, okay, we got to have another bubble. So let's start dropping interest rates like crazy and make it easier and easier for people to borrow against their homes. So the value of houses started going up. So that was the next big bubble, was real estate. So everybody started investing in real estate. And so they'd bundle all these real estate mortgages and resell them as mortgage-backed securities, as if they were stocks. And banks would buy billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions. There were trillions of dollars of U.S. mortgages. Basically, you know, half the house, some mind-boggling percentage of the houses in America had been remortgaged, and those were being resold. They were being bought by companies all over the world. And then when people figured out that, hey, because we had Phil Graham's brilliant idea of deregulating commodities and deregulating the banking industry, Phil Graham, John McCain's economic advisor, his brilliant ideas to create everything from the Enron loophole to deregulating banking and do away with the Glass-Steagall Act, that because this stuff happened, these security, what it did is it opened the door for predators and snake oil salesmen who came in and they started, you know, giving people mortgages when they didn't appropriately deserve to get a mortgage. And the result of that was that, again, that emperor was seen to have no clothes and that bubble burst. The bubble that burst in 1929 was the bubble that everybody could make money on the stock market. And it was because you could buy stock on margin. You could buy stock on 10%. And some brokerages, because it wasn't regulated, some brokerages were even selling stock on 2 and 3%. But the typical was 10%. So you put down 10% and you buy, you know, $1,000 worth of stock for $100. And so people were leveraging stock and it drove the demand for more and more stock. And eventually it reached the point where people were saying, hey, wait a minute, is this stock really worth anything? And that's when it all fell apart. So, yeah, there is a panic is a huge piece of it. But it's the panic that comes with the realization that the bubble was based on nothing. And that's where, I think, frankly, we're at again. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Edgar Browning, author of the new book Stealing from Each Other, he suggests the welfare state is robbing Americans of money and spirit. We're going to talk about Obama's plans. And tax expert Ronnie Deutsch on John McCain's tax plan and what she likes about it. And, of course, the best of the rest of you is, don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.